The only way to create wealth in this business is to be in the game. And we talked about time being one of your best assets, your best asset, period. But part of that time component is if you're not deploying capital, you're not allowing that time to grow your capital account balance and grow your wealth. It's not a get rich quick. It's not a get in and get out really fast. It's deploy capital and sit back and hopefully it's going to go well. So I think that's really what gets in the way the most often is people just not pulling the trigger on that first investment.
Welcome to the Income Flip Podcast, a podcast about real estate entrepreneurs, visionaries, and the stories behind the legacies they're creating. I'm your host, Rob Chavez, and on today's episode, I've got Jacob Vanderslice. Now, Jacob is the co-founder of Van West Partners out of Denver, Colorado. And they started their firm really just buying, fixing, and flipping single-family houses. But over time, started graduating into multifamily and then pivoted to self-storage. Listen to how Jacob is creating a ton of value for him and his partners in creating the income flip through owning storage. Grid. Guess what? Today, I've got Jacob Vanderslice from Denver, Colorado with me. And Jacob, I hear you're going through a heat wave right now. Welcome, my friend. Thank you for joining the Income Flip.
I am happy to be here. And our heat wave is nothing compared to what a lot of listeners are probably going through today. So we don't have it too bad here.
Yeah, man. Yeah, we've got serious humidity right now in our backyard, which some people love, some people hate. I normally like it, but it's been bad. So, well, welcome. What I want to do is explore a little bit about your background because we were sharing some time before we jumped on and you got in 2005 with no finance background, probably just with a dream, right? Tell me, how did it all get started?
Yeah, a sparkle in my eye and a prayer in my heart. That's all that I had. I was in the fire service and I'd always been fascinated with real estate. And, my college buddy and I, he was a general contractor and on our days off, we bought a couple houses, we fixed them up, we did the tile, we did the drywall. We kind of kept adding to the portfolio over time. We didn't know anything about finance, interest rates, net operating income, cap rates. It was just kind of a baptism by fire and we scaled it and got fairly large and, the financial crisis hit and our portfolio got beat up, as you can imagine, but it was kind of this dichotomy. So we've got all these deals that are really suffering, and underperforming and values have dropped. But we started learning how to buy at the trustee sales and we started raising private debts and private equity. And in the left hand, we're kind of getting beat up in our portfolio. In the right hand, we're just stealing deals at a fraction of what they traded for a couple of years ago. And it was a learning experience. And over the following years, we kind of scaled up our single family platform. We did over 1,200, 1,300 fix and flips over the years, buy, fix and sell, buy, fix and rent. Did some town development, some retail repositions. We did some multifamily, we covered a lot of bases in real estate. And then we got self-storage in 2015. Hmm. And we looked at the asset class for a while and we decided that our business was, I don't know if we actually decided this at the time, but in retrospect, maybe we decided our business was kind of overly transactional. So we're having to find a deal, make it better, then sell it and do it over and over and over again to create wealth, build capital, and just to make money. And we concluded the storage business was kind of a shift in that thesis. It's got durable income streams, recurring revenue streams. It's downside protected. You're basically leasing out metal boxes to your customer base on month-to-month leases. So this is our first deal in 2015, and it wasn't really an intentional shift from being a single-family operator to a storage operator. It was kind of just like most organic decisions are, just try a deal out, see how it goes. So we did another one. And then over time, we evolved into being almost exclusively a self-storage owner operator.
And did you start the business with a business partner?
I did.
You said it was your friend from college. Is that right?
Yeah. So we're still really good buddies. He went off on his own and started a big construction company and sold it a few years ago, had a liquidity event. But my first business partner, who's still one of my business partners, Aaron Westfall, he's the West and Van West. I'm the Vanderslice, the Westfall. he joined me in about late 08. Mm-hmm. What opportunity got really interesting. So he kind of missed the downside years and joined me like right at the peak of the financial crisis. He was a software engineer at Qualcomm. And we were college, we were junior high buddies, high school buddies, college roommates. And they say don't work with your friends, but it worked out okay. And then our third partner, Wade Buxton, who really kind of brought our self-storage strategy to the shop. He used to work for us mowing lawns. He got his real estate MBA at the University of Denver. His family owns a storage facility in California. And he's like, this is an asset class you guys should look at. And over time, we started doing deals together. We became partners. And then we brought on a fourth partner, John Sutter, about 18 months ago. And he's been in the business for 9 years and he leads our self-storage development strategy. So I got three partners that I call my other three wives.
Of course.
We've all got our personality conflicts, our moods, our different agendas, but through osmosis, it eventually works out.
Well, I love that. And I love the fact, you know, it really does. You need a talented team around you to build something that is special, right? When I went on your website, I saw somebody that was very thoughtful when it came to technology and just building their brand, right? And so I'm curious, who's the driver of that, right? Who's the driver of your kind of like your backend platform?
That's really on the tech side and finance side, that's mainly Wes Ball. Mm-hmm. He's very detail oriented and I would say far worse things about him if he was sitting here listening, but sometimes he can't see the forest and the trees. He only sees the tree and he will stay all night to reconcile a nickel error in an income statement because he can't figure out what happened. So he is custom built a lot of the software platforms from the ground up that we use to manage our portfolio, report to our investors. We subscribe to some third-party services, but he's built all this stuff internally with a team of software developers that really helps our revenue management out, our underwriting, our acquisitions. Wade is on the operations and acquisition side, so he's our main deal flow guy. Mm-hmm. He's also running our operations team to make sure we're executing our business plan. And then John, who has a ton of experience in the industry, he leads our development program. And development's a different animal, as you well know, between buying an existing asset versus building a new one. And he's very good at navigating those challenges. So it's a good crew. And I just hang out in my office and talk on Zoom.
Do you know Andrew Abernathy, by any chance?
Abernathy Holdings? It rings a bell.
He does storage development primarily in, I want to say, Arizona right now. And you guys, I'll connect both of you. You guys should know each other, right? And by the way, here at Grid, we believe that it's the network, it's the relationships that you form with different investors. Just like you said, you've met your business partner, your friends. Like, these relationships take you places that sometimes just money can't. And we believe that the power is in the network, right?
Agreed.
So I want to go back and talk a little bit about when you had the single family platform, right? You guys are just doing transactional work. You were kind of shifting assets, right? You had these bad assets and then you were buying the good assets. You were dollar cost averaging. That's another way to kind of look at it, right? But making that transition sometimes can be really emotional for people. It's like they're so used to doing one thing and then transitioning that and saying, we're going to develop a new identity is not an easy process for a lot of people. What did you guys discuss? Or was it easy for you, right? Were you guys just like, hey, this just makes more sense? I'm curious as to that mental transition that occurred.
You know, none of this has been easy. It's been a lot of fun, but none of it's been easy. And really the only deals that have been easy, I think, the home runs have kind of come down to luck and timing, and there's a story for execution. And I don't want to discount that we obviously think we know what we're doing, but sometimes the home runs you hit are just market timing, right? Cap rates are depressed, interest rates are down. But the transition really was, I would say anytime we've kind of pivoted strategies, it's been exploratory initially. Like we'll try, and we have a lot of conflict about this in the office. I'm kind of the shiny object guy, and my partner to kind of stay in your lane and focus on one thing. And I mentioned osmosis earlier, and eventually it kind of all works itself out. But the transition was very slow. The first storage deal we bought, so we were doing all these single family deals, and I mentioned we were doing some townhome development, for sale townhome development. We did a lot of adaptive reuse retail, and that was kind of our first foray in commercial. And I'll answer your question in a moment. But we would take these really cool old buildings that were 100 plus years old, brick bomb house, you know, bomb shelters, and demise them and make them beautiful again and put brewery tenants in there, restaurant tenants, yoga studios. But like the single family business, at least in our experience, it was hard to scale that. And people always talk about scale's better. Well, it's true to a degree. But you can only find so many cool, old, busted buildings in a given MSA and reposition them and convert them to retail. So that's kind of how we cut our teeth in commercial, is we were sort of, I wouldn't say we were transitioning out of residential. We were just adding another line of business kind of slowly over time. Mm-hmm. And then self-storage came into play in the same way that our retail repositions did. Let's try a deal out. And the evolution really was, okay, let's try a deal. We raised some capital. We hired a third party to manage it. We did another one. We did about eight that way. And as you kind of continue this transitional evolution, we realized over time that a third party doesn't care about your deal as much as you. Mm-hmm. So their own management platform. And that was kind of our next evolution to being primarily a storage operator. We started self-managing the new deals we were buying. And then eventually we took the deals that we had managed with the REIT partners back from the REITs and started self-managing those. And then as we were building this, just the natural evolution was kind of creating a brand around our self-storage management platforms, but also a brand around raising capital for our different syndications and fund vehicles. Mm-hmm. And the evolution was slow, but eventually we transitioned to where we are today, which is a self-storage on our own.
You know, it's interesting. You say slow, but you know, it's all relative. I look at what you've done that on the storage side front since 2015, and that's relatively fast when you think about it, right? It's like, it's fast. I mean, it's interesting. I think part of it is, I've got a little girl that's 21 now. I'm like, man, how did that happen? Like, that's crazy. Like, it just, time moves pretty fast. And when I look at somebody that's got it, you know, got into the business 2005, kind of then repositioned the business again a decade later, right? Yeah, you're coming up on two decades, right? You're coming up on that, you know.
It's crazy to think about that.
I know, which is crazy, but you're just getting started, right? When you think about it, it's like you guys now wonder. Well, I'm kind of projecting, but I would imagine you guys are like, okay, we understand the lane that we want to play in moving forward and how we add value, right? Moving from kind of this transactional side to what I would almost call like a transformational side, right? It, you know, in our language, we call that the income flip. Like, people, like when we first get into the business, we gotta pay the bills, right? We got rent, you know, we got our mortgage payments, we've got kids, and we've got to do that. But then you start buying assets that over time start paying you back, and equity starts building, and a reputation is built. Raising capital is easier than what it was in 2005, I would imagine, right? So you talked a little bit about capital. Let's talk a little bit about that. What does that look like now, right? If somebody wanted to invest with you?
Well, let me answer that question. Let me back up to a point you made just a moment ago. If I could capture our kind of mental thesis shift, we went from transactional revenue, meaning buying, making better, and selling, to building an asset base that creates recurring revenue. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to learn that wealth is not your net worth. If your net worth is not paying,
can't eat it. I always say that.
Eat it. Yeah. It's like if someone deeded you a $10 million mansion, free and clear, and you've got property taxes, you've got the groundskeeping crew, you've got the utility bills, you're feeding that beast that's not doing anything for you. the only way to monetize that $10 million asset is to sell it or put debt on it and go deploy it somewhere that creates cash flow. So it took us a while to kind of figure that out, many years. I mean, we were making money trading in and out of deals. But that thesis, I think, is going to serve us well as the market shifts. If we don't have to sell or tend to sell, it doesn't matter what the property's worth. As long as you don't have a debt maturity issue, you've got recurring revenues.
There's a lot of debt maturity issues going on right now in the commercial space.
There are. And we can segue into that. But to answer your question about cap, as a lot of the listeners here probably know, there's a variety of different ways to invest in private real estate vehicles. Two of the main food groups, you've got syndications, which is typically a single asset. It's one LLC. The sponsor raises capital, buys a deal, makes distributions, eventually sells. And you've got a fund. And a fund structurally is pretty similar to a syndication, but a fund is a collection of assets. It's almost like you're buying into a mutual fund of that asset class versus buying one stock in that asset class. So we do both. We do our development deals and single asset syndications. We've got a handful of value add deals and syndications that we're kind of in between funds. But we're currently in our third storage fund. About $300 million in assets under management between all the syndications funds. And our funds really are focused on buying existing storage facilities that we can add value to, with capital improvements, but mainly operational efficiencies. And to kind of tie this into the debt maturity, a point that we touched on a moment ago, we're seeing a substantially reduced amount of transaction volume compared to a year ago. Fewer deals are trading, but the deals that we are getting have more attractive pricing and, all things being equal, more attractive targeted returns. And I think a big component of that are all the debt maturity issues that are out there. And these debt maturity issues, I think they transcend asset classes. It's not just storage, it's multifamily, industrial, you name it. But a lot of operators got into floating rate debt 2 years ago at a 2.5% rate, and they stressed their model up to a 4 on year two. We're gonna stress up to a 4, maybe 4.5 to be conservative. Mm-hmm. Our net operating income growth projections. We're gonna refinance the term debt. We're gonna pull 50% proceeds. We're gonna be American heroes. Those floating rate loans, depending on what your spread was, your interest rate has probably gone from 2.5% to maybe close to 8. Mm-hmm. If you did buy a rate cap, and you might have hit your NOI growth targets and maybe even exceeded them, but your revenue did not grow nearly as fast as your cost of capital. So now you're staring at debt maturity in the face. What are your options? Well, let's say you want to refinance. You don't want to sell yet. Well, lenders have pulled back the proceeds. They've reduced generally their loan cost, and obviously interest rates are a lot higher. So you're in a position where you can refi, but you have to call your investors up to bring capital to them. Or your other option, which is not fun to do. Thankfully, we've never had to do that. Mm-hmm. But that's not a fun call to make, and it's not a fun call to receive on the investor side. So you can refi and bring cash to the table, or you can sell. Well, the valuation that you want is probably the valuation that you had a year or two ago. And the buyers looking at your deal are looking at their model and their spreadsheet, and they're having the same debt problem that you are in your refinance. They're saying, dude, I can't pin you this price because my interest rate's going to be a 7 and I'm only getting 55% proceeds from my bank. Mm-hmm. Pay a lot less. So it's a complicated environment right now. If you've got debt maturity runway and you've got a fixed rate, maybe the value of your property's gone down, but again, you don't necessarily care because you don't have to refinance it. And if you're not trying to sell it, you're good to go. But that's where we're seeing a little bit more opportunity. I'm not saying that asset valuations on a macro level have gone down, but we're seeing more attractive acquisition opportunities, although more infrequent acquisition opportunities, largely because of these floating rate debt issues.
Yeah. Yeah. And
feel that time, Marcus, it's all.
Yeah. And you're going to find, you know, I had friends that, you know, over the last 5-6 years, they got aggressive and they didn't, and nobody thought to model it out at 8%, right?
No, we wouldn't have dreamt of doing
it.
It mattered. One of our lenders a couple of years ago, lenders will do a stress test, and they'll assign that stress test with a certain interest rate that's much higher than rates are today. And they were stressing us at a 6.5. And we're like, dude, this is so conservative. Come on. Screw us. We're like, well, you know, bankers. Well, the banker was, we were all wrong. But the banker was less wrong than we were. But yeah, no one dreamt. We all knew rates were low. We all knew rates were going to go up, obviously. But none of us could have comprehended how fast this has happened.
Yeah.
It's been with market.
I don't think
the market values are not reflecting this rise in the cost of capital yet. They're starting to. But it's going to take a while for this to kind of work its way into the system.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. And like in all shifts, there's opportunity in those shifts. You got to figure out which pockets you're going to play in. You had a massive shift to happen in 2007, 2008. You guys had to figure out which pockets to play in, right? There's always, same thing with us. Like when I went through that, I was like, okay. On the agent side of the business, the short sale agents and the REO agents were killing it. And so we moved our business kind of in that direction. Yep. And then we bought assets because I was like, well, everything looks 50% off to me. Like, I'm like, everything is 50% off.
I remember those, like you were yesterday. I mean, banks had short sale departments. There were short sale brokerages.
Oh,
they specialized in that. I mean, it was a whole ship.
It was massive. And I just looked back and said, we should have bought more, but whatever. Hindsight.
Don't get me started there, Rob. I try to think about all the stuff that we've sold that we shouldn't have sold. And have we had the discipline and the foresight to hang on, it would be a different story. But who knows?
You know, what's interesting is like when I'll organize these panels of investors, right? And I'll bring, a lot of investors together for a mastermind. And I'll always ask, what's the number one regret? And it's always like that I sold, right? That I sold. It's like we sometimes have to sell because we need to reposition our portfolio. We need to raise some capital because of other stuff that's happened. But they're like, if I just kept everything, figured out a way to keep what we had, game over.
Yeah. I talk out both sides of my mouth on this and lots of other things for that matter. But philosophically, we don't like selling, but then we'll sell it, to kind of shore up a balance sheet, or we feel like we've kind of maximized the value. But we had a pretty elderly investor fill out a web form, and you fill out a web form on our website. We give you a call. We talk shop and see what your investment objectives are. And he sounded old on the phone. He told me eventually he was 80. Gosh, I don't know. Want to accept capital. I mean, from someone kind of later in life, right? We're longer term holders. And I was like, "Have you done real estate before?" He's like, "Oh yeah, I've got about $50 million worth of it all my life." And he's like, "When are you boys planning on selling your deals?" And I was like, "Oh, sir, 7-year hold, this IRR, this multiple." And he told me something very profound. And he's like, the problem with selling, right? And I'm like, no, I'm thinking taxes or whatever. He's like, problem with selling is you don't own any. Like, oh, that's pretty profound. That's very true. Anymore.
Yeah.
It's a time and a place to sell, but, building up an asset base that's responsibly financed, that pays you in your sleep, getting rid of that, you pay a big tax bill and your recurring revenue is over.
So that leads me to a question. Because you guys, I said, yes, you're going to be 2 decades in the business, but you got in relatively young, in the business. Where do you want to take it the next 10, 15, 20 years? What's the vision? And of course that's a long time, but, I suspect maybe you guys have talked a little bit about it within your business.
Yeah, in our industry, it's a lot of money to you and I, but I mentioned our portfolio is about $300 million in value. And that's relatively small for self-storage. We're up there, I think, in the top 50 owner-operators, but I think the dream is to continue responsibly accumulating assets on a deal by deal basis, whether it's building a new facility or buying a value at acquisition. And then when it's appropriate, either recapitalize the portfolio with new debt or new equity, or potentially sell it all, or hopefully a compressed cap rate. Often you see values go up, cap rates go down when there's scale. Buyers will generally pay a premium. It's kind of greater. The sum is greater than the whole. The parts basically. So it's hard to say. I mean, we've tractioned and we've done EOS. Really, our thesis is just keep buying responsibly.
Sure.
When deals we love, don't do them. If we have a deal come up that's created just a ton of value, like rent it for a 10 cap and it's worth a 5 cap, you know, maybe that makes sense to harvest some of that value creation. Again, I talk out both sides of my mouth, right? Don't sell.
But yeah.
Yeah. But really just keep kind of building our recurring revenue streams and our asset base, protect our investors, protect downside. But we like cash flow and so do our LPs. It's very pleasing every quarter when we ship out a bunch of cash, from just net operating income and net cash flow, and our investors like it. And if you sell, that goes away.
That goes away for sure. Yeah. You know, and this is a game that we could play forever. I mean, you look at Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett. I was just referencing them earlier, and you know, they love playing the game. Like, they could have.
Doing deals is fun.
That's right.
It is.
Doing deals is fun.
I'm a great buyer, and I'm always, as you can probably infer, a remorseful seller. But when you close on a new acquisition, you've got the dream of the upside on the deal, the excitement of the transition, and can we hit our numbers and adding another asset base to the portfolio. Doing deals is just fun.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, independent from how much money I make or may not make, I think I'm always going to be doing deals.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about fun. I see a propeller in the back. I read that you're a pilot, right? When did you become a pilot?
Yeah, I rent junky Cessnas. So that's calling me a pilot is probably pretty generous. I started flying when I was 17.
Okay.
I got my license when I was 18. I got my instrument rating in college. Aviation is kind of a lifelong passion. I've always loved anything that flies. And we've got a bunch of drones that we use for filling our different deals and doing due diligence and roof inspection. So I'm the drone pilot in addition to my other roles. But yeah, I love flying. I kind of get in and out of it. So I'll fall out of currency for a year. Then I'll go back and train and get my currency back. And I'll fly like once a week for a year. Then I'll kind of fall out again. I've got two little kids that are 5 and 3. So my time for extracurricular pursuits has been diminished as of late, but I still get up once in a while.
Yeah, man, you're in the weeds.
Oh, yeah.
You're heavy in the weeds.
Two little boys that are 16 months apart. We're, got a lot going on.
That's fun though. Magical times, right?
They are.
Yeah. Get like another 5 years is like kind of like the golden spot, right? They could do their own. They can do a lot of stuff on their own. It's fun. It's a lot of fun with them.
Yeah.
Do you hang glide or do anything like that?
No, I worked on my helicopter rating some years ago. I didn't finish it. I just, again, life got in the way. It's also really expensive. I do a lot of mountain climbing though, golf, big skier, backpacking, and I like to drink bourbon too.
It was funny because I told my wife I wanted to get like my helicopter my license, and she's like, "Hell no!" She's like, "No, no way, no way."
Helicopters are different than airplanes. They're magical taking off and landing. Point A to point B, it's kind of the same thing, just a lot more money. But yeah,
I wouldn't have thought of that. I would have thought it would have been cheaper, but I guess not. Well, so let's talk a little bit about life and business integration, right? How do you view that? How do you manage that, right? Father to, you're building this business. How do you think about your month, your quarter, your year when it comes to integrating your family and your business?
Could go on and on about the philosophy on this, but in a nutshell, it's calendar block. That's what they do. We have a lot of folks will book calls with me using the scheduling lane, kind of like you use, but it's integrated with our CRM. So I'll block certain times off. Like, get back to be home early for the kids, like at 3:30 one day block. I very rarely come into the office on weekends. I'm not a work from home guy. Just because I'm not good at it, I get distracted. I'm going to, you know, make a sandwich real quick and maybe I'll watch TV for a few minutes, but I'm at the office at work. So I'm always monitoring, but weekends are pretty sacred. After hours are sacred. We take them on little trips here and there. But balancing family and a business is a challenge. And that's one of the reasons that we wanted to keep increasing these recurring revenue streams. So just like a big theme of your shop is exactly that, converting active income to passive income, which allows us to hire more people. And there's always someone out there who can do your job better than you. No matter how good you think you might be, we're all replaceable. So my partners and I eventually would like to get replaced, which would be awesome. And we're okay paying for that replacement, free of that. The greatest asset, really the only asset we all have, is time.
Yeah.
That's it. You never encounter somebody or hear stories about someone on their deathbed saying, I should have done more deals. I should have made more money. That's never anyone's regret. It's, I should have traveled more. I should have spent more time with my family, with my wife, my kids. So that's kind of the into the means here is curating the business in a way where we can kind of eventually get there. Not taking our feet off the gas or hand off the wheel, so to speak, but just freeing up more time for the stuff that really matters.
Yeah. You know, it took me a while to figure that out. I think that hit me around 45, right? Up until that point, I was just like, more, faster, harder, right? Like I wrestled D1 in college, and that was just like, you know, I was just used to that kind of level of intensity. Win, right? And it's like, whoa, wait a second. Like, what are we really doing this for? Right. And I think part of the wake up call was when I was like, shoot, my little girl is not so little anymore. I only have a few years where we're going to be able to like really spend time together. Right. And so I'm definitely passionate about helping people understand how to convert their active income to passive income. And so what do you think normally gets in people's way when it comes to that, right? Like where do people fall short?
I think often it's indecision and it's waiting for the perfect deal. It's reading the books, it's listening to the podcasts, going to the seminars, going to the masterminds, but never actually taking action. The only way to create wealth in this business is to be in the game. And we talked about time being one of your best assets, your best asset, period. But part of that time component is if you're not deploying capital, you're not allowing that time to grow your capital account balance and grow your wealth. It's not a get rich quick. It's not a get in and get out really fast. It's deploy capital and sit back and hopefully it's going to go well. So I think that's really what gets in the way the most often is people just not pulling the trigger on that first investment. We have a lot of investors who are in 25 or 30 different syndications and funds. Like they've been at the game for a while. We have other investors where it's their first limited partner investment. And taking that step of signing documents and wiring someone your money is a big step. And that's tough. But once you do it for the first time and you start to see distributions, you start to see reporting, and the sponsor calls you back when you have your first question after you funded, and start to realize, oh, maybe this actually works. And it doesn't work all the time, especially lately. The tide's going out for a lot of folks, just with all the different challenges we described earlier. But I think just inaction is what gets in people's way the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they don't allow time to kind of take care of it, right? They just gotta get in the game.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not a big Tony Robbins guy necessarily, but one quote I like of his is the road of someday leads to the town of nowhere.
Yeah.
I think that's it. I'm not exactly sure if that's the right quote, but
I'm sure somebody could look at you and say, well, okay, that's easy for you, Jacob, because, you know, you got your pilot's license at 17, you're a firefighter, right? Like you definitely sound like somebody that just said, okay, I'm going to go do stuff, right? How old were you when you guys started the investment business?
We bought our first rental property when I was 22.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was it that you were like, okay, did you grow up in an entrepreneurial household? Did you see somebody do it? Like what's
Yeah, it was more of a ladder. So a really close family friend of ours I remember he's been an investor of ours. He's a great guy. But he did a lot of residential investing, and he had this huge place in an out town in Colorado called Breckenridge. And we were up there skiing with him in probably like 2003. And at the time, he's on this kind of janky Windows touchscreen phone, kind of when smartphones first came out. And he was typing out an email. He was talking on the phone here and there on the chairlift. And I was like, what's going on? He's like, oh, we're just closing the deal today. I was talking to the title company. And I started talking to him more about his business and what he did. And I was just fascinated by it. And dude, how do we get started? He's like, yeah, we got to go buy a deal. Mm-hmm. I'll give you some guidance and, you know, kind of tell you some pitfalls to think about, like financing and assumptions and all that. But I was kind of enamored by being an entrepreneur in real estate. I've always looked for assets. I'm not that smart. I can understand a house or a storage facility. I can't understand stocks or bonds. So that was really kind of the crux of the getting into the business. And for better or for worse, I have to kind of jump head first. So jumped head first into single family and kept going.
And so if you, I mean, I'm assuming that you like storage more than single family, right? You guys could have gone the multifamily route, right? You could have kind of, I've seen people make the transition from like buying and fixing houses to then buying rentals, duplexes, then scaling those duplexes into, you know, kind of the multifamily side. I mean, you guys went storage, right?
Yeah, we did a fair amount of apartment deals over the years, but again, we traded out of those, and we shouldn't have, right? Who knew how good it was going to get? But yeah, storage, we just concluded was downside protected. And we've been waiting on a downturn since,
oh yeah,
I would say 12, 13.
Yeah.
We thought, man, values have really run back up, and there's a lot of multifamily construction. There's got to be something that's going to break loose here soon. And like we often are, we were wrong, right? Just kept going. Then COVID hit, and we thought, I hate to even bring up COVID, but
sure.
Yeah, you know, we're all past that. At least I am. But that, you know, we're sitting in the office in March of 20, and we're thinking, we know what we're doing. We've got a fair amount of capital backing us. We're going to clean up, right? The world is going to go on sale. We're going to buy everything just like we did in 2008, but we didn't know much in 08, but now we do. And went the opposite direction, right? The run up in values was not only unprecedented, but it was irrational and untenable. And now things have kind of moderated. They haven't necessarily gone down, but they're certainly not going up a lot. It's certainly not like they were. So we've been waiting for a downturn that's never come. Maybe a downturn's coming here in Q4. This elusive recession we've been hearing about. I've got a screenshot on my phone from the Drudge Report website from a year ago, in red font and like a big stop sign, recession imminent, recession looming. And here we are, right?
Yeah.
Throw this through the roof. The stock market's gone way up the last week. Unemployment's low. Well, we'll see what happens. But
it's interesting because 2012, 2013, I think one of my biggest regrets was that I was like, I stopped buying. I was like, it's right around the corner. This thing, I think maybe I had PTSD from 2008, 2009.
Oh, yeah. And I still do.
Yeah. And I bought things at such cheap prices that by 2012, 2013, I remember my best friend started buying around 2013 for the first time. And like, he was really more of a stock guy. And then he started kind of buying. And I remember thinking, dude, you're like, you missed it.
Yeah.
You missed it. Right. And then here we are now, and I'm like, shit, it just never came, right? Like,
no.
And when COVID hit, I had the opposite. I was like, oh shit, we're in trouble. Who the hell's going to buy a house during this thing, right? I'm like, we're screwed. Our infrastructure cost is massive. And then it was like a match off to the races, right? And like, we sold more than we'd ever sold before. And so now I'm like, okay, let's be vigilant about what's going to really happen over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And I'm like, I keep thinking that we're protected on the residential side because there's just no inventory. And I think that commercial office is probably the most vulnerable asset class out there. But what the hell do I know? Like, I haven't been right all along. And so it's one of these things where I'm just like, okay, let's just be cautious with the amount of debt that we take on. Let's strategically buy things that make sense that we can cash flow today. Definitely, I regret not buying as much as I did, you know, from 2012 to really 2018, 2019.
Yep.
So I'm like, I'm just going to start buying more, right? Things that make sense.
Yeah, I think deal fundamentals are what matters most. We have a lot of our investors call us up and they'll ask, what should I do, right? Should I sit on cash? Should I wait till things devalue a bunch and then kind of jump in the market? And we don't have a strong answer for that. But the problem with thinking that way is, number one, you're suggesting you can time the market. And in my experience, and I'm sure yours too, you don't know you're in the trough until a year later, right? Maybe even 2 years later. You certainly don't know you're in it when you're in it. Can't you feel like it's a falling knife? There's more to go. Let's be careful. Let's turn capital. So you can't time the market. And secondly, that also assumes there's going to be a downturn, right? There may not be. Could just be a rational moderation of value increases. The values go up just at a lower rate. Interest rates might come back down to earth at least somewhat, maybe by the end of next year. So you assume you can time the market and you assume there's going to be a trough. You can't time the market and you're not going to know you're in the trough until way in the rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? Well, there's not a good time to buy. There's not a bad time to buy. There are just good deals and there are bad deals.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make money in the most buoyant, irrationally increasing market. And you can make money when the wheels are coming off the bus if you just stick to fundamentals.
Yeah, it's just cash flow, right? It goes back to the whole conversation of we can't eat net worth, but what we can really rely on is the cash flow, right? And then mitigate the risk by just kind of understanding like how long is that debt out there for, you know, is it going to adjust? You know, we've been buying a lot of properties sub two, so subject to the existing financing that's there.
Yeah, we did some of those too in our portfolio from years ago. Those have been just home runs.
Yeah. And so it's interesting. It's like, okay, we're just going to be more opportunistic and make sure that we were just buying things from day one that we can cash flow, right?
Yep.
Well, if people wanted to learn more about investing in storage units, right? And learning more about your business, do they go to your site? Like what's the best way to get it?
Yeah, they can go to our website, vanwestpartners.com, or they can email me. Jacob@vanwestpartners.com, or they can hit me on LinkedIn, Jacob Vanderslice. We always love talking shop about real estate. If you have a storage deal that you've heard about that might be interesting, we'd love to hear about that. If you want advice on how to get in the business on your own, buy your first facility, we're happy to talk about that. But there's a lot of ways to participate in the asset class beyond just buying stock and extra space, for example.
I've got a question around that, right? Because having a thesis around buying storage, right? Like there's a thesis around buying storage, but then there's a thesis around where you're going to be buying storage and why you're going to be buying there and like what the actual buy box looks like for you guys, right? The gentleman that I talked about, Andrew, he only develops storage facilities in really expensive markets, right? Mm-hmm. Like kind of like, and he does kind of like luxury type of storage facilities. And then, one of the big ones then does all the management for him. I forget the name. Like one of the big,
Space, CubeSmart, Public.
Those Public. Kind of, I think Public does like all the, and so they're really kind of in the storage development. And then they've integrated all these other businesses, like, you know, they've integrated all these different businesses into their storage space. Like, I forget, like the rolling doors and all this other kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
And his whole thesis is like where we find pieces of land in expensive markets that kind of other people don't do, and we build luxury facilities there.
Yeah, that's a good development thesis. The risk in development mainly is the risk of new supply. So if you buy some land and you build a storage facility and a bunch of other people have the same idea at the same time, if you all deliver at a similar point in time, self-storage is very local supply sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
But with the supply shock to the market, which happened in 2017 in Denver, rates and occupancies go down and it's kind of a race to the bottom to fill up your facility.
Mm-hmm.
They always eventually fill up, but you got to be able to hang on for the debt and cash flow perspective to kind of get there to stabilization. So we target similar development sites. I would say they're, I don't want to say luxury necessarily, but they're multi-story, climate control, class A, new construction. And we target sites and markets with really high barriers to entry for development. A very difficult entitlement process. Land isn't zoned for it. So we closed on a deal in Southeast Denver about a month and a half ago. We've been under contract and in entitlements on this deal for a year and a half. And we're just about to get our building printed. So it's a long process for someone to actually go out and replicate a similar competing product nearby, if they even can. As far as our buy box goes for value out acquisitions, the first thing we look at are supply ratios in the submarket. How many square feet per capita of storage is there in the 1, 3, and 5 mile trade radius? Mm-hmm. And different markets can sustain different supply ratios. Some markets you might say are oversupplied, but all the facilities are full, I should say, because the rents are. So supply ratios, we look at deals that have in place below market rents that we can raise up to market rates. We look at deals with low physical occupancy that we can leverage our management platform to fill those units up. But beyond that, it's the standard real estate fundamentals, good location, good demographics, a good story for wage and income growth. Mm-hmm. We try to stay away from markets where people are leaving. We want to see mm-hmm. population grow, desirable places to live, business-friendly environments, for sure. With that being said, though, not there's anything wrong with Illinois. We got a bunch of stuff in Illinois. And you don't think Illinois fits that? Well, there's some of our best-performing properties. So storage, like a lot of other real estate, is very local, so market-sensitive. Mm-hmm. You could say that Illinois is oversupplied. Well, there's pockets in Illinois that are great submarkets to be in. So supply ratios, demographics are all kind of factors that go into our buy box.
What other areas are you guys in besides Denver and Illinois? What markets would you like to enter into?
Yeah.
When it comes across anything.
Our newest market that we're in, as of today, we bought a 2-property portfolio in Cheyenne, Wyoming, for Denver. We've got deals in Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, Georgia, Oklahoma, Arizona, obviously Colorado, Illinois, Wisconsin. So we generally like this is most true, I guess, but we like the Midwest, Southeast, Southwest, West. We haven't done anything in California. We have one deal we have in California. It's kind of a legacy asset. But beyond that one, not really anything west of Denver, kind of Mountain West and East, and just very submarket demographic focus.
Do some research on Virginia, Northern Virginia.
Yeah, we did a few deals in Virginia. We haven't gotten them to pencil, but that's a good market. And these better markets, these more primary markets, believe it or not, with interest rates, cap rates are still very compressed and values are still very high. I'm not sure how that works when you're buying a deal at a 4 cap and financing in a 7, but somehow deals are still trading in compressed cap rates. We'll see when the tide goes out, how those deals perform. But some great markets out there.
Awesome, man. Well, Jacob, I appreciate you spending some time with us today. I really do.
Thank you too.
What's the website URL?
VanWestPartners.com or email me, Jacob@VanWestPartners.com.
Awesome. Jacob, have a great day, man. Enjoy.
You too. Thanks again.
Take care. Bye-bye.